Hello and welcome back to Back in My Play. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and before we get into this week's episode, I want to fill you in on something cool that we're doing. If you go to teespring.com/backinmyplay, that's teespring.com/backinmyplay, you'll see that we're trying to get 50 t-shirts sold, and if we can hit that mark, we're going to be able to get these t-shirts made, plus raise a little bit more than $350 for charity, and I'd love to donate that money to the Boston Children's Hospital. So again, if we can get 50 shirts sold, A, you'll get an awesome t-shirt with our logo on it. These are high quality shirts. I went with, you know, I bumped it up a little bit. It didn't go with the basic. I went with a nicer shirt, so it's going to last longer and it's going to be a lot more comfortable. Plus, again, for $18 plus shipping, which is, if you're in the United States, it's about $4. If we can sell 50 of these, we're going to raise more than $350. All the proceeds from these shirts are going directly to the Boston Children's Hospital. So every single penny that is able to be raised through this project. Again, plus you'll be able to get an awesome t-shirt and you'll help, you know, spread the word of Back in My Play. So there's multiple wins here, guys, if you check them out. Again, you can go to teespring.com/backinmyplay. Please, if you enjoy the show and you're willing to help us out, I'd really appreciate it. And yeah, that's it. Thanks, as always, for listening. Here is an awesome interview with Mike Micah, and you'll see why we're going to be having him on a lot in the future. Hello, and welcome back to Back in My Play. This is another Back in My Play Guide In episode, a game episode that does not focus on a particular game, but it focuses around retro games. And I'm very happy to have on the line for this episode, Mike Micah. Mike, how you doing?
Doing great, Kevin, and this is awesome to be here. I'm really a big fan, and I can't wait to talk about all these games we've been meaning to talk about for a while.
I know, like, it has been really great to do these, just talk to people that really love games, and we always, being a retro game podcast, we tend to go back to the old stuff, the stuff that we have really great memories of, and you know, that's the thing that I've always seen when I've seen you or hear you talk about games. You have just such a passion for this stuff, so it's going to be a lot of fun today. So the first thing I want to get started off with, just to do like a brief introduction, because you have, you know, a great history in video games and in development and in really your massive collection down in the GIMP room, which we'll get to. So let's start off with that. Like, how did you, you know, get into the industry? Like, when did you know, like, video games are going to be playing a vital part in the rest of your life?
It really started back in, I'd say probably third or fourth grade in elementary school, when my teacher wheeled in the one of two Apple II home computers that they had purchased for the school and started to show us that like the power of the Apple II and what it could do. And there was this simple game where you had part of the educational disc that came with it, where you had to guide a rabbit through a maze and try to get to a carrot. And I just looked at that and I realized, okay, this is what they make video games with. Those games I play in the arcade and the games I play on my Atari, there's a machine here and you can type in programs to do this. So I would stay in on recess and we would learn how to program the Apple II, my friend and I. And we came with all these crude little games. We had like a helicopter game. We had this game where you're running down a street and just trying to like karate chop people in the head and all stuff. And it was just amazing because we'd do this. And then our friends, like, we would skip our, you know, our healthy recess. And our friends would come in and they would see what we were working on and get so jazzed about it and so excited that they started to draw pictures and come up with ideas. And it dawned on me that, like, I'm making things that people like and enjoy. And then they want to participate in that. It was this weird euphoria. It was amazing. And so from that point on, my father had purchased a Commodore 64 for us, and because he had seen the passion I had for making games, and I would just make these games and I would share them with everybody I knew, and their excitement would just fuel me and it made me want to do more and more with it. So it was those home computers, those early 80 home computers, the Commodore and the Apple, that really set me on the direction I've taken in my career.
Speaking of the Apple II, did that come with a manual or some paperwork to get you started with programming? How did you get access to that stuff?
So we would ride our dirt bikes up to the party store that had all this giant magazine rack, and they had these computer magazines. We didn't have enough money to buy them, so we would just go up there and we'd just observe it, try to remember everything we saw about it. We'd see commands and these sorts of things, and we would even take notes. We had this little pad of paper we'd bring up there and write down the program, so it was even harder. It was like we wouldn't buy the magazine. We'd just look at it, write it all down, make mistakes writing it down, and then we'd end up having to debug that on our own. And we did have a few magazines that we would save up enough to get, and we would type in those programs and we'd hack those games. There was a game that was like this old game called Caverns of Mars, but it was on an Apple II version. And you're a ship going down a cavern, you couldn't touch the walls. It was very much like Flappy Bird on its side. And we put that in, and then we decided we could probably put in our own art and that sort of thing. So we would hack these other games and we'd learn from doing that. And that's pretty much how I learned how to program. I didn't actually, I had some books, but I spent more time hacking other games to figure out how they worked. And I would make my own games that way.
So for the last 30 some odd years, you've been creating video games. And up until this point, how many games do you think that you've, in total shipped?
It's a scary number. Like I have actually lost count, but at one point someone had made a list for me of the games that I had at least enough interaction and input on, and maybe some engineering or design work. And it was sitting around 130 now,
Wow.
I think, which is, I work on these smaller games. I've always worked on smaller games, the kind of arcadey sort of games. So they don't take as long. So I'm able to do a lot in a year compared to other people. It's like I was a small indie developer before indie developers were cool.
Well, it's funny. I was doing some research for the show, and going through Google, I found an old article or an interview on IGN with you talking about developing for the Game Boy Color, because as you probably saw in the questions that I sent you, I've been on a really bad Neo Geo Pocket hole. And it's just really cool to even see you talking about, yeah, like, yeah, we'd love to develop for the Neo Geo Pocket, but we just don't have they haven't given us the stuff to do it yet. But that's how far back that we're talking. That's really how in depth that you've been into this. So it's really cool. Hitting on the arcade stuff, I gotta ask you, are you just a really big fan of the arcade scene? Like those are the games that you want to develop, like kind of those games that, someone would put in a quarter and you just have like, 3 minutes of awesome fun?
That's exactly it. That's what I grew up with. I would save up my money and we'd ride up to this golf course by our house that had an arcade, and we would just spend it all there and we'd play everything we could get our hands on. And if we didn't have enough money, we'd go and watch people play. And then when I finally got my home computer, I would come home after that and I'd try to recreate those games. I remember the first game I actually made at home was a replica of the game Moon Patrol. And
That's
it was
awesome.
like amazing because I would try to memorize everything I could from the game and how it behaved, and then come home and recreate it. And when I finally started working professionally, it was an advantage for me having grown up like that, because the first amount of work I started to get when I got into the industry was ports. But oftentimes they would not have the source code to the game, so they're like, "What can we do to make this game?" And I'm like, "Well, I've done this my whole life. I've just looked at games and make them." So a lot of my original games that I worked on back in the Game Boy days were just based on observing the game and recreating it.
Crazy. So you're like trying to almost mimic the gravity of Moon Patrol
Yeah,
at home.
exactly. And add my little flourishes here and there. Like maybe I wanted the missiles to be faster, to fire more, or do that sort of thing.
Oh,
But
so you're improving on the games too.
yeah, at least I thought so. Other people, some of them couldn't stand it, where it's like, "Oh, come on, slow this down or speed that up." Like when you work on a game, you tend to, especially when you're making it for yourself and your friends, you tend to just like make it customized just for you. So if your reflexes are better than your buddy's, guess what? Like he's not gonna be able to play it or any sorts of things. So that was also another thing I learned from those early days, was trying to make everybody happy meant that I would have to like listen to people's opinions about things.
That's one thing that really saddens me about the future youth, is they're not going to have those memories of, yeah, my arcade, the arcade that, I stuck my fingers into every one of those coin return slots to see if they had quarters because I was out. And you know what? A lot of times you'd probably find one or two.
Oh yeah, you know what? There was this arcade, a place called Meyer Thrifty Acres in Michigan that we would go to. And there was a Frogger machine, and some guy was there, and he showed us this trick. He's like, if you kick the coin return hard enough, you get a free play. And it worked. We would go there, and we kicked the heck out of this machine, and you'd see like the coins just going up, the credits going up in the game, and we would just spend like the whole hour there playing Frogger on free play, basically. It was awesome. But that scene and the people you'd run into, like you'd find out about all these tricks, you'd watch people who were experts or maybe the best in the world playing a game, that was just, you can't recreate that anymore. And being, now that we're online, it's even more like disconnected. I love the social aspects of those early arcades, and also I like the social aspects of early game systems like Bomberman, and gathering people around to play Bomberman was epic. And like when you play online, it just doesn't feel the same when you're playing against somebody somewhere else in the world. I love that we can do that, and that's fantastic, but it feels like it's sort of cheapening the social interaction a bit.
Well, it's funny. I think I was talking to Steve Lin about this, just the really resurgence of, oh, we were talking about Windjammers and just the playing with my buddy, and you know, the resurgence of that couch competitive multiplayer and how that seems to be coming back with things like Sports Friends and things like that. And it definitely seems like there is a market. Maybe it's just going from the arcade to almost like, you know, having a party at your house.
Yeah, exactly. We would set up, I'd say probably every week we had a Bomberman tournament.
What's the best Bomberman? What is the definitive? Is it the Saturn? Is it the Bomberman 93? Is it 94?
So, you know, that's such a good question because I'm a huge Bomberman fan, and I sometimes get in big arguments about this. And every game brings something to the table, but at the end of the day, I probably fall back on Super Bomberman 2 on Super Nintendo as being the best version. Now, Saturn Bomberman's great. I love it. And if you want to play more than five people, or four people in this case, have at it. And that's one we default to because usually we want to have like a big crowd playing. Mm-hmm. And then Bomberman 93 is just really kind of, if you think about it, that's the Bible for Bomberman. Everything kind of falls back there. Mm-hmm. But Super Bomberman 2 was the one that we would just religiously play over and over again. And I feel like I know that like better than Kasparov chess.
Did that make it out to the United States? I've seen it in Japan, but did that come out in the US too?
The Super Bomberman 2?
Yeah.
Yes, it did, definitely. It followed pretty quickly after Super Bomberman, and the key innovation it brought was the blue gloves, the ones that you can actually pick up the bombs and throw over walls. And that changed the dynamic completely. And the other part of it, too, is you could actually customize the game a little bit, each level that you kind of went into. So we'd have our settings that we would call the tournament settings we would have and that sort of thing. So it's really upped the ante on the kind of things you could do with Bomberman. I eventually would work on a Bomberman game for XBLA and PSN. I forget the name of it, but it was like basically the only Bomberman game on Xbox 360. And we basically at the very beginning just took the best of every game out there, every Bomberman game, and tried to throw it all into one pot. And for better or for worse, but I think overall the guy who headed up that project, I just know him as Snake. That's what we'd always call him. Steve Snakeus, I think is his name. He just owned that. Like, he was probably the biggest Bomberman fan I've ever met in my life. He took that project and what we wanted to do with it and went much further, and it turned out great.
So let's, man, this is already starting off great. I know this is going to be fun. So, talking about being, when I started this podcast, it was all about just, I wanted to like share nostalgic memories of games and things like that. Because when I look back on, you know, my childhood, some of my best memories were surrounded by, you know, video games with friends, or man, I can't believe I beat this game. So I got to ask you, what are some of your fondest memories involving video games?
You know, there's a few that really stand out. They're not like these epic moments or anything, but my late grandfather, I remember he came to visit us up in Michigan. He lived in Tennessee. And when I remember when they arrived and walked in the house, because I was such a huge Moon Patrol fan, and I had an Atari 2600, and I kept asking for Moon Patrol. I didn't get it for my birthday, and it was out there, and I kept reading every article about it. So like I asked my grandfather if I could have that for Christmas. And he came walking in, and he had, you know, the presents. He put them under the tree, and I saw that particular shape that I knew every Atari game box was. So I just knew it was Moon Patrol. But even more, the box was the wrapping on it was a little bit ripped, and so when everybody went to sleep, I like got up. It was like 2 a.m. I did my stealthy little move to the living room, and looked under the tree and just pulled that paper back a little bit and confirmed it was Moon Patrol. So I couldn't sleep the whole night. I was just like, I would try to go to sleep and I couldn't. I'm like, I've got Moon Patrol. And so the hardest thing for me to do that next morning was to act surprised when I opened it, and then still stick around to open up the rest of the gifts with the family. But like, I just wanted to run downstairs and put it in the Atari. And when I did, it was awesome. I put in the game, and it was, you know, everything I was hoping for, except for I didn't hear the music, and I thought it was supposed to have music. Moon Patrol has this very awesome soundtrack to it. It was one of the first games to have an actual score, this like kind of rhythmic background music that was just mind-blowing at the time. And I was just really kind of disappointed. My grandfather came down, and he's just like, oh, it looks like you're having fun, but like you don't seem to be what's bothering you or whatever. I'm like, oh, I thought it was going to have the music or whatever. And so he just like kind of leans back, and he opens the box, pulls the manual out, looking through it, and then just like leans over and switches the difficulty switch, and the music just came on. And it was mind-blowing. And I never read manuals or anything, but ever since that moment, I'm like, I better read the manual and just understand what this game has to offer. It was awesome.
Good call. I mean, that's funny. I think that's another memory a lot of us share is, you know, finding that particular box, whether it's like an NES box or, you know, a Sega Genesis box under the Christmas tree. It's just, you know exactly what it is. Yep. And you're just kind of like, I need to see if I can just rip it open slightly and not get caught. But yeah, that's awesome. Anything else that comes to mind?
Well, there's so many, like, there's small ones too. I started working at a magazine called Next Generation in 97. And I had played, you know, GoldenEye and other first person shooters, but this one came in that was in prototype. We're getting an early peek of it, and we all got copies of it. It was called Tribes for PC. Mm-hmm. A really great multiplayer game. And that was my first experience with getting griefed. I was on a team with Frank O'Connor, who's now creative director or something like that for the Halo franchise now at Microsoft. He was working at another magazine at the time, and he and I took on like 8 other people because we're pretty good at it. And we just like spent the like 2 hours just destroying everybody, and we're on the verge of like basically breaking this record and everything. And Frank just like in the game like kind of turns to me and says like, hey, look at me. And I looked over, and he did a headshot on his own teammate, and it was the first time I've experienced a team kill, and all that euphoria I had just like went out the window. It was terrible. I was so depressed about it, even though it was this dumb thing. Like, I just didn't want to play it anymore. I'm like, Frank, how could you do that? We've been through so much. But like, yeah, it just stuck with me. It was a very funny moment. And now every game I make and everything that has multiplayer, I try to at least enhance the team kill abilities, because I just want to pass that on to the next generation.
Yeah, it totally prepared you for the, you know, the the huge surge of Call of Duty players on Xbox Live.
Oh man, Call of Duty! Every time there's a new game, I am almost too hesitant to try to get online, because within 15 minutes there are a billion more experts than I am at that game, and it's so frustrating. Yeah, I love it though.
Well, it's like, you know, when you were, you know, 14, 15, 16, you were the expert at that game because you had, you know, nothing but time to play that game. These guys, exactly, are just so good.
And here I am, like, I'm trying really hard, and I'll even practice. And I'm like, okay, I'm in a good position, I'll go in there. And I'm just getting my, you know, ass handed to me, and it's always with some kids, and they're like, Mom, I'll take the garbage out later, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, these punks. They're multitasking when they kill me too. It sucks.
Man, let's bring this back to retro stuff. They're getting too close to current gen. So let's let's talk about at least I alluded to your collection, because this is something you are well known for. You have your collection, or I believe you still do, in this place that you call the GIMP room. What's yeah, this all about?
When I moved in 97 or late 96 to the Bay Area, I didn't bring much with me. I left at my parents' house this kind of vast collection. I kept every game I ever got when I was a kid. So I had, you can imagine, starting with Pong through Atari and NES, Super Nintendo and all stuff. I just didn't have the space when I moved out to the Bay Area because I was going to get this one-bedroom apartment with my girlfriend. And so I kind of left that all there, but I knew, like, I had, because I had gone through all this, I knew everything about it, and I was at the magazine. Everybody knew I was a big classic game fan. So coming into the Bay Area, where a lot of these classic games were developed, I would run into and interview all these people who were making PlayStation games that worked on old Atari games or worked on old Genesis games and these sorts of things. So they would find out that I was really into this stuff, and they would just show up and give me things. They would say, oh, here's this prototype game that never came out, and I figured you seem to be into this, you can have it, and these sorts of things. So I started to amass this collection of oddities. Like, I have like a what was it, the 3DO M2 production or the development board that goes into a Mac, so you can develop games for the 3DO M2 that never came out. I've got source code for M2 games. I have bizarre PlayStation games that should never have seen the light of day and just managed to just eke by and get a gold disc of, or even weird prototype Atari games, these sorts of things. So people just started to give this to me, and I had no room for it. I had this closet in the one-bedroom apartment. But when I decided to move over to the East Bay, closer to where I'm working now, I had the opportunity to buy a house. And when we went to go look at it, it was a friend of mine's house. He had this hole in the closet floor with a ladder going down. And he had referred to it as a gimp room based off of Pulp Fiction. And he's like, you got to check this out. So I went down this ladder, and he just had a big TV in there and like recliners. It was like his man cave. And in my mind, I'm thinking, like, this is brilliant. I could put all my stuff down here and like wouldn't bother anybody. And my wife, when we decided to buy the house, was like, that's right. Everything that you have, all that game stuff you have, below the house. Everything else is mine. I'm like, deal. So it's just, at that point, you open the floodgates because everybody just would drop stuff off. I had one guy call me up and he's like, I've got a whole bunch of Atari stuff. I don't even know what I have, but I don't want it anymore. Do you want it? And I'm like, yeah. So he shows up, he opens this trunk, and it's a full trunk full of 2600 games and some really amazing games like King Kong and mm-hmm. Pengo and Sword Quest, Waterworld, stuff like that, right? Just really rare stuff, but a lot of it. And so I took that in and I just put it in there. And I would just imagine this happening over and over again. But eventually, it just became, people would tell me, like, wow, you've got a lot of game stuff. And I'm like, really? Really? I do? And it dawned on me slowly that I started to have this gigantic collection. And it wasn't just that it was common stuff. I really like to focus more on like real odd things, like rare prototypes or whatever, or things that were, you know, a little more personal to me. Like I'll remember playing a game with a friend or whatever. Like I had a friend who passed away a few years ago, and he and I would always play Bruce Lee on his Atari computer. I remember the box that he had for it and all stuff. So when I ran across Bruce Lee, I got that because I'm like, oh, this means something to me. I got to have it. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix of that kind of stuff and maybe a little bit of toys here and there from like Shogun Warriors and stuff like that. But it's like it's half probably like my biography of sorts of my life, because all these things were such an influence on me that you might as well just say that is me. And the rest of it is trying to preserve those things, because there would be these cases when people are like, I don't know what to do with this. And they would tell me what it was. And I'm like, this is probably one of a kind. Like, where's this going to go? And at the time, many years ago, there were no museums. There were no people making collections to have on display or just for preservation's sake. So I would just hold on to this stuff. And now that there's all these museums showing up, like the Video Game History Museum and the Smithsonian. I just donated something to the Smithsonian, which is fantastic. I can start to push this collection out to places that I know are going to take care of it better than I would, of course.
Two things that I want to hit on and stuff that you brought up. One, again, as part of my research, there's a really great episode of I talked to Steve about this too, but A Life Well Wasted.
Oh, yeah.
That you're on, about basically video game collectors. And listen to that as just kind of an add-on for this episode, because there's also some really good stuff in there. And in that, you mentioned that you have a Star Wars arcade machine, the sit-down cockpit machine down there. How did you get that down there?
Oh, so there is a side door that connects to the garage that most people wouldn't even notice if you go in there. And that's the only way I can get those things in there without tearing them apart. Although we've just remodeled the house, I have no idea how any of this stuff's going to get out. We kind of built it in an impossible way to get anything in or out of that place now. But it's in there, and that's all that matters. And it ends up being a support system for all the stuff above it, because it's sort of like acts as a support for this big shelf that has even more game stuff just piled on top. It's probably not the best thing I should be doing with it, but it still works.
Well, good luck. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is just talking about preserving this stuff and you know, the new museums that are popping up in the Smithsonian now. Accepting items. Do you know how are they displaying that? Are they devoting a lot of space to video game history at the Smithsonian now?
So they started an exhibition that is touring right now. So the exhibition is actually going to multiple museums across the country. It started at the Smithsonian. And they are bringing things around. Half the stuff you'll see in that exhibition right now is probably mine. They showed up one day with a truck and a list of things they wanted. And it was exciting, but like it was kind of funny because these guys who are picking the stuff up for the Smithsonian are used to picking things up that are priceless. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming out with the glove treatment. They have this like hydraulically balanced truck and everything. It's just like anything that goes in this truck, it won't even feel a bump when it's traveling across the country. Wow. And meanwhile, I'm dragging out these like bins, just dropping them on the ground, like, oh, here's an Atari, here's this, or whatever. They're like trying to grab everything. But yeah, if you go around, you'll see like a lot of stuff that's in there. There's things like a friend of mine put in a copy of like Mule for the PC Junior. There's systems on display, like the Master System, a lot of common systems, that sort of thing. But the best thing that Smithsonian did was to approach it with a new flavor, and that they knew that if the Smithsonian acknowledges games as being works of art, that that will open doors for games. And that's exactly what happened. They kind of came out with the support of all their benefactors and said, we believe video games are art. And mm-hmm. So it kind of ends an age-old argument. And as a result of that, other museums now are starting to display more and starting to take what they would normally have just held on to and not know what to do with it. They're starting to see, thanks to the Smithsonian, that they can actually display these things and display them in a context of critique and that sort of thing.
That's such a weird argument. When I was hearing that back in, you know, the early aughts, when people were arguing about this, and I always just looked at it this way: like anyone's creation is art. Like they're creating something with, you know, their knowledge and their mind. So it is. Art, no matter how other way you justify it, I don't know.
To me, they've always been art. Everything I looked at, I would think was the worst looking game still looked like a thing of beauty to me. So it was just like somebody made that. And it's an expression, and I how could it not be art?
Urban Champion is art.
Urban Champion is art. I don't care what anybody says. Tiger Heli is art.
That's not. Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. So we've talked about this. You know, we talked about the collection a little bit. Do you have a number in mind of how many pieces that you have in terms of games?
You know, I haven't really tried counting, but there is a lot, and it's hard to decide which things to count and which ones to not count. Mm-hmm. There's a debate raging online right now on whether you should count computer games, which blows my mind. But then there is, you know, you have computer games, but what if their copies are not legitimate, or there's multiple computer games on one disc and all stuff. So I have no idea. It's in the thousands. I don't think I'm a world record holder by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a good quality thousands.
So how often do you go back and play these games? I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I might have turning around, I might have like maybe 150 games at any odd time. And, you know, even sometimes that seems like a lot to choose from. Do you ever, you know, feel like it's hard to kind of go back and play this stuff just because there's so many choices?
Oh yeah. It's like that. Even people, if you're a child of the 80s, you would know what it means to have like video store syndrome, which is like you would go to the video store and not have any idea what to pick because there's so many. I have that, of course. But what I've tried to do is anytime anybody visits or comes by and wants to see the place or just play some games, we just go down there and we just blindly grab things. Mm-hmm. And we're like, we're going to play this. And not only are we going to play it, we're going to try to get like the high score in it, or we're going to do whatever. Because more important, like to me, is the fact that these games were a way to bring people together. So we're just going to play all these bizarre games. And so I've had celebrities over, I've had like game industry veterans over, adult stuff. And we always do the same thing. We just go around and find something that kind of grabs our interest, pull it out, and just spend hours on it. There's a game that we would play called Tree Surgeon. And I don't know if you've heard of this game.
No.
It's an Atari 800 game. You're a guy who basically has to stop this rapidly growing tree from getting into the pool, its roots getting into the pool, or its branches touching the power lines and all stuff. So you have this saw and a shovel. You're going around trying to cut these things off. Meanwhile, squirrels and all these things are trying to stop you for some reason. And then when you've bundled up all this wood, the next level is you have to take it to the dump, but the dump is very hard to get to because there's snakes and all these other things. It's so weird, but it's such a fun, bizarre game. It is really cool. I recommend people look it up. There's multiple levels and it looked nice. And so we had one time Jimmy Fallon, now of The Tonight Show, which is awesome. He came by. We worked with him on some stuff before. And we spent probably 2 hours playing Tree Surgeon with Chris Charla, Jimmy Fallon, myself, sitting in my little GIMP room. It was bizarre.
So it is true. He is into the games. It is that, I think, has been the greatest thing to see is on his show, him just showcasing video games on there and being truly enthusiastic about that stuff when, you know, whether it's Reggie coming over, you know, guys from Sony to show off stuff, it is really cool to see that.
You know, that's I see people give him grief sometimes or whatever, but like having known him and like worked with him on game related things, the guy is legitimately a huge game fan. He's really smart, and if I recall correctly, I think he was even like, I think he went to school as a computer science engineer, and I think he wanted to make games and then happened upon comedy. But the guy is brilliant, and some of the stuff we worked on, I wish people could see some of this stuff, because he has a game designer's mind and he really thinks things through. It's not just some celebrity that wants to make games. Like, he understands it intimately. So,
well, you can see it when he's like playing through a game on TV. Like, he'll be making suggestions and you'll be like, yeah, actually, why didn't they do that?
Yeah, he's really good. So I always stand up for that guy. If anybody tries to trash him on, you know, what he's doing with games, like, be happy he's pushing that agenda forward, and he's doing it in a very cool way on television.
So with this massive collection, you have it kind of almost in the basement. How do you store it? Do you take any steps to, you know, preserve this stuff? Do you have it in, like, I know some people put like all their box games in these plastic protectors and things like that. How do you like to store this stuff?
You know, I wish I said I did all that. Like, I do it by keeping them safely off the ground and keep the room at a certain temperature, and I have like a dehumidifier, all that sort of thing. But I don't actually do the plastic cases. When Chris Kohler from Wired comes over, he yells at me probably for 15 minutes before we actually start having fun, because he's just so upset with the way I store games. But he's right. I should actually be protecting these games a little bit more, because when I have people come over, they like to pull them out and look at them and that sort of thing. And when they're doing that, they're just, you know, rubbing up against each other. It's up against some wood maybe or stuff.
Oily
on the shelf.
Hands, man.
Oily hands, all that stuff. And you know, the proper practice would be getting those things properly cased. Like, I have a lot of just unopened Super Nintendo games. And some of them, like, people come over just because they want to hold them. Like, things like Metal Warriors or Nosferatu and stuff like that.
Okay.
And, like, there's people come over, they just want to stare at it and stuff. But, like, they're pulling it out, and I had one of the games, I forget which one it was, somebody pulled out, and as they pulled it out, all the shrink wrap tore off. And, like, I personally don't really care about that, but the fact that the person who did it felt so horrified. And then not only that, like, he was the one telling me, like, this game's worth a lot of money, and I actually just messed it up. And it's like, well, okay, that's cool, but I'm sure there's more out there. But there's some of those that I know that are one of a kind that I have that I should be doing that with. So anybody who's listening, do it, don't wait. I do that, and that's what happened. I should not have done that.
Yeah, and I forget the actual website. I don't know if you know if Top Hand Steve Lin mentioned it in the interview that I did with him, but you can get these cases online, and they make them specially for each platform. So
they do. Like, I don't know it off the top of my head, but we should link to it afterwards. It's absolutely a great site. They have cases custom made for every kind of game, and it's definitely what you want to do. They don't take up much more space, so it'll pretty much, the games will generally fit in the same place you had them before, and they'll be more protected. It's worth it.
Speaking of Mr. Steve Lin, I got to talking to him about video game auctions and the crazy things that kind of pop up and the deals that can be found. So since you're in this same realm, I have to ask, have you come across any like crazy game auction stories or just like crazy deals that you lucked out on?
I got pretty lucky. I go to this antique fair here in the Bay Area in Alameda, and it's usually, you know, furniture and whatever, but every so often some game things show up. And I was there with my wife, and I saw there was a table with some Atari games. I went over there, and the woman selling the games had probably a dozen prototype Atari 2600 games, some that were unreleased and not even released, not even dumped and released, so they're odd versions of things. And so I just asked the woman, I'm like, what about these games here? And she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. The labels, somebody just put a different label on it, because, you know, these prototypes have like these little handwritten labels on them. She's like, for those games, just $2. That's fine. Like, the other ones are $5. I'm like, really? Okay. So I just bought them all. I even gave her like an extra $5. And it was amazing, because each one of these things is probably worth $200 to $300, wow, maybe even more. One of the games like wasn't even, people didn't even know it existed. So that one's probably even more priceless. But I come across those things every so often, and I'm always posting on Twitter or Facebook, and I get a lot of people who wish they could send me death threats over some of the deals I get. But one of the better ones in the last couple of years that woke me up to the reality that some of these games are starting to go up in value faster than I thought was, a friend of mine had a sealed copy of Metal Warriors. He called me up, and he's like, what should I post this on eBay for, like starting bid and all this stuff, and what do you think I could get for it? And Frank Cifaldi, who's an excellent kind of historian, video game historian, who has his finger on the pulse for pricing on Super Nintendo, NES, and lots of other systems. He was with me at the time, so he was giving some advice, and we said, like, you'll probably get like $200 to $300 for it, and that was up until then, that was kind of the going rate. Mm-hmm. The bid went up to, I think, $2,500, and then after it closed, people continued to contact the seller, trying to offer him up to $5,000 for this sealed copy of Metal Warriors by Konami. It blew my mind. At that point, I'm like, okay, this market's changing overnight. Things that were literally like months before just worth maybe $50 or $60 have gone up like to $300 to $400. So it's scary because things like that, you have no idea. You have no idea that a game like that can make that kind of money. So it's getting a lot more challenging for people to know what the market value is. And you look at something like some of these NES games that go for like $13,000, like, you know, of course, the big one, the sports, I can't believe I'm forgetting it right now. You know which one I'm talking about. Like that goes up there and it's, you know, sells for $13,000. Somebody could follow that and it never breaks like $800. So it's like, there's only probably three or four people willing to spend that amount of money. But it kind of ruins the balance of the rest of the market because people start to overvalue everything. Now you see games up there that are sitting at $500 and they've been up there for a year, mm-hmm. just waiting for some sucker to come along and spend that kind of money.
Yeah, that's something that has been really hard to watch, and it's why I've been just devoting most of my money to my trips to Japan and just buying a lot of stuff over there. Just I don't really need to have the US version. If I have something that will play the game and I don't need to read Japanese for it, then exactly. You can get, you know, so many games out there for much cheaper and usually in better condition.
Absolutely. I run into stuff all the time when I'm traveling overseas that are even I'll find US copies of things overseas in game stores mm-hmm. that are like a fifth the price of what I could find locally.
You seen that copy of Star Tropics over at Trader? Yeah. Japan? That Steve, like, it's so funny that Steve brought that up because I talked about that like 3 months ago on the podcast, because that was like two copies of Star Tropics that have been sitting in that Trader store with like a copy of Mortal Kombat 3, I think, for the Super Nintendo for at least the last 3 years that I've been going to Japan. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. continuing on, and then we'll take a quick break. What are some of the coolest pieces that come to your mind in your collection? Obviously, you're talking about having a lot of stuff that's been unreleased, some prototype stuff, and one of the coolest things that I've seen that you have is a real copy of Half-Life for the Dreamcast, which I played about halfway through before I went crazy and before I ran into this like a VMU bug. Where the save file gets too big.
Yep.
I ran into that problem. But I was wondering if people don't know about that, you get to tell the story behind that. And then also just, you know, some of the coolest pieces that you have in your collection.
Absolutely. The Half-Life for Dreamcast, that was a game I really wanted in the day when it was announced. There was ads for it. And I had it on PC, but I was one of those guys who grew up wanting to play first-person shooters on console more than PC, which is blasphemy for most people. But after GoldenEye, I went down that path. And so I was very anxious to get Half-Life. And we would get demos of it when I was at the magazine. So I was just like craving it. And then it just got canceled. And it was kind of a shame because it looked like a great port. It combined Blue Shift. I forgot what the expansion pack is. So it included the expansion pack and stuff. And so it was a really solid game. And it just kind of disappeared and fell off the radar. I think eventually somebody had found a copy and posted it up online so it could play a pirated version. But a friend
that's
of mine.
That is not how I played it.
Not how you played it.
Well, I know who's going to come after me, right? Because it wasn't even released.
No, it was never released. And you know what? Like, it had to come from somebody close to the team, right?
Yeah.
And so it kind of went out there, and people would start playing it and talk about how good it was and it should have shipped and that sort of thing. And there was a lot of problems with it, that VMU bug you talked about mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. But a friend of mine who I'd known for a long time, he just showed up one day with a version that was basically final. It was the final packaging and everything. And he's like, this thing, there's only two of these that I know of. He's like, I've got one and now you have one. And he's like, don't tell anybody who gave it to you. Don't do any of this stuff, but you can have it. And so it was like one of those crazy moments where it's like, I have this thing and it's it's amazing, and there probably is only two copies of this thing out there. So I have that, which is great. People come by, and that's almost the number one thing everybody wants to come and check out, is they just want to hold the Half-Life mm-hmm. yeah. for Dreamcast. And then I also have a ton of just bizarre things, like I have some clay characters from the Neverhood game that was on PC. It was a wow. it was a claymation stop-motion adventure game by Doug Chnapple and crew from the Neverhood, Mike mm-hmm. Dietz and Ed Schofield. Fantastic game, brilliant art direction. It was just awesome. And at one point, they had contacted my company about potentially doing a Game Boy game with those characters. And I, as I usually do, I impressed upon them how much of a fan I was. And then a week later, I had a box full of T-shirts and then all these bubble-wrapped characters from the set from the game that they just had lying around. I still have I have all those. They're all on display in that room as well. To me, I mean, there's probably not many people know much about that game, but to me, that was like huge. And I also have some original sculpts of the McFarlane Metal Gear Solid figures, the clay sculpts that they use to create the action figures with. So they're like these larger sculptures, and they're carved in a way that they can break them apart where the arms come off, and they could scan them in 3D and then create the actual action figure from it. A friend of mine, who's a friend of a friend who worked at McFarlane, knew that these things would be something I'd be interested in, and ended up just shipping me a box with those. And not only that, but also they would make these one-off pewter versions of the Metal Gear characters. Mm-hmm. And they were supposed to go to somewhere else at McFarlane, and it ended up in my basement. And now I've got these one-off pewter Metal Gear action figures that are really amazing to look at. I've caught several people trying to walk off with those. Let's see, what else do I have? Oh, you know what? One of my favorites is I have Clay Fighter for PlayStation. It's not that it's a good game, but it's a game that we all thought was completely lost. And I managed to get a copy of that. Someone who worked on the game just blindly sent me this thing and said, this is the only copy. He didn't even back it up. He's like, I just want to make sure it gets saved. So I got that. And it's the Clay Fighter Extreme PlayStation game that, like, you may have seen screenshots or whatever, but it was pretty far along. You could pick several of the characters. It had Earthworm Jim in it and all that stuff. It was pretty cool. Yeah, it's awesome.
Man, that's funny that you bring that up, because that is one of those games that it unfortunately gets talked about a lot on the podcast, because we had to pick that over Street Fighter 2 because Street Fighter 2 is too violent.
Yep.
My mom bought us Clay Fighter. One thing I wanted to reference real quick, something that you brought up, just people knowing that you would want this stuff. I think it was Chris Kohler said it one time at a PAX panel, that just tell people, don't be ashamed. Tell people that you are interested in this stuff, and you will find that people have stuff in their attic or their garage or their closet, that, or maybe they just have like a PS2 and a bunch of games that they don't want anymore, and they don't want to go through the hassle of eBay. They'll just give them to you.
You know, I hear this so often. Like, I run across people who've been in the game industry forever, and I'll meet them and I'll tell them all this stuff, and they'll be like, if I had only known you wanted this stuff, I wouldn't have thrown it out.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they talk about stuff like prototype games. They talk about like hardware that nobody's ever seen before. They put all this stuff, and it's oh man, it crushes your soul when you hear this stuff. And so now, like, no matter who I talk to, like, I almost get out there as soon as possible because I want to know if they have anything. And one of the things early in my career that was beneficial for this was I was working on my first Game Boy game for fun. I was hacking the Game Boy and trying to figure out how to make stuff on it. And I made a version of Yar's Revenge, one of my favorite games when I was a kid. And I put it out there, and somebody just emailed me out of the blue and said, you know what? I know the guy who made the original Yar's Revenge. Would you like to meet him? And I'm like, great. So I email him, and the guy, it was Howard Scott Warshaw, popular guy. People know him in the game industry. He's like, so where are you? And I'm like, I'm in Michigan, thinking like, I'm furthest from where he is. He's in California. He's like, well, I happen to be out in Michigan next week. We should get drinks. And so I ended up meeting Howard Scott Warshaw. I found out what his dream vision of a sequel to Yar's Revenge would be, and some of the stuff that was, you know, on the cutting room floor. And not only that, I got permission from him to go ahead and do any of those ideas he had and make them better. And he gave me insights into who I should be talking about getting rights. And eventually that game came out. It came out on Game Boy. It was my first games, and it shows it's one of my first games, not the best in the world, but I put a lot of love into it. And I also put a lot of those ideas and concepts that Howard talked about, because I just felt that's what fans wanted and that sort of thing. But I never would have had that opportunity if I hadn't just shared with the internet and the world that this is what I want to do. And I could talk more about that a little bit later when we talk about one of the games I'm working on.
Yeah, let's take a quick break just to throw in some awesome music, and we'll come back. We'll continue, and when we come from the break, I want to ask you what your favorite console or platform was to develop for. So we'll be right back.
Shelter in the neutral zone, no revenge. Occupy the Zolan cannon, no revenge. Try to win the swan time, no revenge. Try to break the Sportar shield, no revenge.
Okay, we're back. So, like I said before we went to break, you've developed on so many different platforms, starting with the Game Boy. What's your favorite of all time to develop for, and why?
It's difficult. I have done a lot, and the one that I'm most nostalgic for professionally is probably the Game Boy Color. It was that time when I kind of broken. I kind of came into my own on the Game Boy Color in my career, and I ended up working on a lot of Game Boy Color games. And it wasn't just the amount either. It was the fact that I felt like I understood that system inside and out. I did a game called Disney's Tarzan, and it's like a licensed game or whatever, but it was my opportunity to make a game that was like the games I loved on Genesis, like Aladdin and like Lion King and those kind of games. And so we went full bore on that game. I spent day and night, day one to completion, which was probably only like 3 to 4 months. We're doing these things really quick. And we're working with Disney animators and all this stuff. And the hardware, I just got so good at doing that, using that hardware. I could push thousands of frames of animation through it. I could do sampled audio, which was all still kind of new. We did full motion video. That game there had all those aspects in it for the first time. And I remember we got a call from Nintendo, and they were just literally just calling to say, "Hey, you did a really great job on that game." And that was like, yes. That hardware was awesome. And the other part of that too is I ended up making a lot of games with some of my best friends. A lot of the people I grew up with moved out here to help me make these games. And so it was like this weird kind of like, I'm with family, we're making all these games, we're having a great time, and we just did a lot of them. And the hardware was just perfect to me.
The Game Boy Color has a lot of games on it that really just pushed the crap out of that hardware, including like Resident Evil. Like when they,
yeah,
I guess that only kind of leaks of that came out, but even that was incredibly impressive. And they did have at least one Resident Evil game come out for it, right?
They did. And the demo version that ultimately never came out, I remember playing that one because we were working with Capcom on Ghosts and Goblins, and I think it was 1942 and on another game. And they would show us what that other team was doing with Resident Evil. And I was blown away. I thought it was incredible, great technology. It ended up not playing, in hindsight, not playing as good as I thought it did back then. But it was still, I think, better than the other Resident Evil game that came out.
Yeah, jump on YouTube. And I think there's still some clips up there where you can check it out. It is, it's pretty amazing. Just kind of going through... I'm sorry. We have a ton of questions for you, but so I need to. This is where I'm going to just ask one for myself, and I talked about it before, but I have to talk a little bit about Neo Geo Pocket Color because I go through these horrible things. Like when I talked to Steve, I was on Neo Geo MVS carts, and now I just have a crap ton of Neo Geo MVS stuff, and I'm looking for the next thing because we got like our bonuses for it. So I got some. I want to buy some stuff. So. I ended up buying 4 Neo Geo Pocket Colors in the last week. Of course, one, the slim one from Japan that's completely clear.
Awesome.
One, it's like kind of the cloudy clear one that came out in the US, but someone on eBay is actually selling brand new units for $100, which is more than the retail was back then, but it's a brand new Neo Geo Pocket Color. And then a couple others that just because they had games and it worked out to be about even money. So I need to talk to you a little bit about this because it seems like the Neo Geo Pocket Color outside of NeoGeo.com has kind of lost, the love when it comes to retro gamers. It doesn't seem to – it's not a system that was purchased obviously a lot from people. I think they only sold about 2 million units. But I was one of those people that traded in my Game Boy Pocket and you know, a bunch of games to get a Neo Geo Pocket Color and a copy of Sonic the Hedgehog or Sonic yeah. Pocket Adventures. So I got to ask you, do you have any special memories of the system or games that you enjoy going back to that like I should keep a lookout for to pick up?
I mean, you probably have all the really good ones for it, but when that system came out, we had imported it, and someone in the office, had, like when it arrived, we all stopped working and just gathered around that thing, and we were blown away. Like I thought Game Boy Color was, you know, the high end of the low handhelds, but once Neo Geo came out, it was everything about it was perfect. I mean, the size felt right, the controller was that Micro Switch style D pad that like it would click as you moved it around, and you're like you knew you were registering your diagonals and everything. It was just perfect. It was built to handle anything. And one of the first games I believe he had gotten was a Metal Slug game, which was just incredible. It was a really great port. And then there was a version of Pac-Man that had the little adapter you'd put on the controller so that it could be a four-way controller and be exactly like the arcade. All that, like when you see some, Neo Geo went so far as to make that little adapter, meant that like it just sold the whole notion that Neo Geo knew exactly what you wanted and that it was going to be perfect. And anything you got on it was like the Criterion edition of gaming for handheld. Mm-hmm. And so I immediately got one probably like a week later, and everybody else in the office, we would spend more time playing our Neo Geo Pocket than we probably should have been at the time. And the games that stood out for me, I was a classic arcade nut. So like, they even had a version of Crush Roller, which was called Make Tracks here in the US in the arcades. And it's a game that I had always wanted on the Atari and any other system, and it never come out. They made a version of it for Neo Geo Pocket, and I grabbed that thing. It's like a Pac-Man, but you're painting the lanes mm-hmm. and stuff. And so I played the hell out of that. I played all the Samurai Showdown games, and then the card games, the card battling games, the SNK versus Capcom, right? The card, those were unbelievable. So you have Pokemon out, which Pokemon's great and everything like that, but then Neo Geo had that, and it was fantastic. And there's many times that I've wanted to just go and make that game over and over again. And someday I will make a game like that. But those games were just so high quality. And that Sonic you were talking about, Sonic Pocket Edition,
yeah,
I believe that team that made that game went on to make some Sonic games later for Game Boy Advance and stuff. But that was that standout game. You would see that and you're like, Game Boy cannot do that. There's no way Game Boy could do that. And it felt right. It felt like it went back to what the Sonic we all wanted and everything. And that, to me, was my favorite games for that system. And it was the game that I would show people that made them just immediately go out and buy it just to have a proper Sonic game again.
Well, I was so easily influenced by the workers at my local electronics boutique to the point where I walked into the store on a Saturday, saw the demo unit set up with Sonic, and the guy at the counter said, oh yeah, you know, and also, do you have a Dreamcast? I'm like, yeah, I just, you know, got a Dreamcast a couple months ago. You know, you can link this to your Dreamcast. You can link your portable console to your Dreamcast. Like, this is before the Game Boy Advance was doing it. And, you know, even today, like the 3DS, not necessarily always talking to the Wii U, but even back then, like that great partnership with SNK, and this is just for people, for if you don't know what the boot up's like, it had a great boot up noise.
Yep.
it's just so good in terms of the fighting games you brought up, the Match of Millennium, the fighting games feel just great and still
they feel
today,
perfect. Yeah, they feel great. Like they were master craftsmen. They built great games on, you know, MVS and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they brought that to bring a game from like an arcade machine like that down to that handheld and that hardware. It's basically impossible, but they figured it out. They figured out how to make the backgrounds that sort of like almost white, almost muted, whited out background that helps separate it from the foreground elements. Mm-hmm. They didn't have many colors, and they would do that, and it would just come across. It just looked amazing, and they perfected it. I was so sold on the Neo Geo Pocket as the winning platform that it was funny you brought that old interview, because I remember going around to publishers and like every opportunity saying we can do a Neo Geo Pocket game, and none of them wanted to hear it. They're just already before that system had a chance, they are already counting it out. And it was kind of depressing, because we eventually did, after that interview, we ended up getting hardware from Neo Geo to develop games. And we did a few little demos and that sort of thing. We would shop them around, but nobody was interested.
Yeah, it's just such a bummer because it still looks like it's still a sleek looking console today, and you know, you get 20 hours on battery, and if you want to get one, they're still cheap on eBay, and there's some, I don't know, well, I guess it does make sense. There's people out there that are still selling like the four packs like of sealed games, like for nothing. Like it's like $12 for four games on eBay. And these are like the best four games that you can get. But that's how I brought, when I was at the arcade, I was always playing Marvel versus Capcom, and I brought it home, not on the Dreamcast, but with Match of the Millennium on the Neo Geo Pocket Color. And it just had the super moves. It blew my mind. It was so great.
It was awesome. And it was so ahead of its time in some of those game concepts that now, when you think about like modern games, mobile games and this sort of thing, it's like time is, I probably would have done so much better right now on like an iPhone or something, but that's kind of surprising to me. It was like 10 years ago. I ended up going to Tokyo, and came across these vending machines that had Neo Geo Pockets in them. And so, a friend of mine, we're trying them out and everything. We ended up getting like 3 Neo Geo Pockets for like $5.
What?
It was insane. There was just clearly an overstock of some kind of Neo Geo Pocket systems.
Oh man. That's one of those things that when I get back there, they have kind of a crazy assortment of colors, and we never got the slim version here in the United States, so I'm sure it will. And they're cheap over there. They're like $20. They're really not
it's
expensive.
So cheap.
But we're gonna have to talk about that again down the road. some couple topics that you threw over to me, but before we get into that, you're talking about do I just call it TXK?
I think that's what you call it. I was like, somebody said T times K, which sounds too hard to say. So it's TXK, which is Jeff Minter's game, just came out on Vita.
Okay. We'll just call it Tempest on the Vita, Tempest 2000 on the Vita.
Exactly.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say, it just came out. I was blown away. I had heard he was working on it, and I've been following him on Twitter. And then I just started seeing a whole rush of people talking about their scores on it. So it was a mad dash just a couple days ago to go grab it. I've not been able to put it down. It's awesome.
Isn't it like a beautiful mesh of, you know, current technology and just like the sound effects of old Tempest? And I've gone into arcade ownership a little bit, but Tempest is hard to pick up. It's like the vector games are hard to keep up, and Tempest is always super expensive. So I only played Tempest on the, I think it was the, it was one arcade collection that was like out during the Pentium 100 days. Like it was just a really old package with like Battlezone and stuff. So that was the only time I ever played Tempest. But for the last 2 days, I've been addicted to this. It is nuts. It's so good.
What's your score on it right now?
Terrible. It's not good. I'm still. It's so
sub million. Are you sub million?
I have my Vita right here. Let me pull it up.
it's awesome. Like I started playing it, and my kids get around and they just like to watch it because it's so visually stunning too. And I can imagine it was challenging for Jeff Minter. Those who don't know Jeff Minter, he's been around since the early days of gaming. Like his games, he was probably the prototypical independent game developer. He made games that had llamas in them because he would raise llamas. He had games about mowing lawns because he hated mowing lawns. And so he made them fun in his game. So he created this series of games that were purely independent, and he would just sell them on his own, and he would make a living doing that. And he's done this for 40 years now. And his games are very unique. He's always got llamas or some other bizarre thing, and he likes to do crazy visualizer effects. So it's kind of created this niche audience for him. But when he did Tempest 2000, when he created that for the Atari Jaguar, he kind of pulled back on the reins a bit. He held back from being classic Jeff Minter and putting all these crazy aesthetics into it and just made kind of like a pure sequel Tempest. And when he did that, he found the perfect audience and the perfect game for a larger audience. And that thing sold Jaguar systems, a system that hardly anybody wanted would buy it because Tempest 2000 was on it. And so this TXK game is like the spiritual sequel to Tempest 2000. And it's mind-boggling. It's so fun. I can't stop. But right now, talking about it, I just want to play it.
It's a beautiful game. And my score is like sub 500,000. I'm new to
I think I may have just broke 2 million. But you know, the good thing is you get to start on that last level you did. And it starts the score near the score you had when you like finally defeat the last level. So it's easy to continue from there and still get those high scores without playing through the whole game. It's very much like the old Tempest.
And yeah, I got to play some more of that. It is really great to see these reinventions of old games. I can't tell you how many hours I put into the Pac-Man Championship Edition on, you know, PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, like both versions of that game, just like amazing. Like it was a complete reinvention of the mechanics. It was just so good.
And it just works now with modern aesthetic. I've worked on a lot of remakes of classic games, and the approach I always try to take is make the game you remember in your head, not the actual game you used to play. Because when you put somebody who's not grown up with those games in front of those games, they tend to actually not like the game at all. Doesn't feel right. It's just too bizarre for them. But if you can recreate that game as you see it in your head, you will ultimately like implement modern controls and all these sorts of things, yet try to capture everything about that game that you loved from nostalgia and what you remember playing. So the net result is ideally something like Pac-Man DX, right? Which is just beautiful, or TXK, which is amazing. And then sometimes that falls flat because, you know, if you're not really good at the craft, it ends up looking terrible. I won't mention any of those games, but TXK is one of those better games.
So another thing that we were talking about, just kind of going through emails and stuff like that, were you know, classic game collections, and you mentioned Ed Free's Rally X port, ported Rally X to the Atari 2600 in 4K. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that for people who don't know what that's all about.
Yeah, so Ed Fries, for those who don't know, he's a longtime game industry veteran, best known for being one of the four people who rallied at Microsoft to create the Xbox. Mm-hmm. He was also the guy who was behind acquiring Bungie, or working out whatever deal they had to get Bungie and Halo onto the Xbox. He's been making games since he was a kid. He worked on Princess and the Frog and a bunch of other games for the Atari 800. And so he does the Xbox, does all these great things, and now he's kind of in a position where he wants to still have fun making games without all the crazy burden of modern politics and making games and whatever. Budgets. At least that's my interpretation. Yeah, budgets and timelines and all stuff. And, you know, I think he's in a position that he can do that for fun. And so he's kind of gone back and he's like, I want to make Atari games because I like making them, and I like making them with the same limitations that people had back then. So the first game that he had done for the Atari 2600 that I was aware of, I was at a game developer conference with my friend Chris. We're just walking down, looking at everything, and we ran into Ed, and we just started talking, and he was talking about, he was reading this book called Racing the Beam, which is by Ian Bogost, great book, that he was really wanting to make an Atari game. In fact, he had started making a little Halo game for 2600, and we're like, so what are you going to do with it? And he's like, oh, I kind of put it down. So we just kept hitting him really hard. We're like, you got to keep doing it, got to keep doing it. And we'd bug him, and finally, he's like, yeah, I'm going to keep doing it. And he created a Halo for 2600, got permission from Microsoft to produce it on a real cartridge, and it went for sale online, and you could buy this $20 version of Halo for an old 2600, and it played great, and he did it all in 4K. 4K, to give you context, it's like 4,096 bytes is less than most emails you send in a day, or that sort of thing, and he managed to put this big adventure shooter in that 4K. And so his latest game that he's working on is a port of a game called Rally X by Namco. It was a 8-way scrolling game where you're a car trying to pick up all these flags while these other cars are trying to run into you and end the game. And it's a challenging game because back in the day on Atari, a lot of companies wanted to make that game for Atari, but technically had no idea how to do it. So Ed tackled that next, and it's great. It's a great conversion. It's not 8-way, it's 4-way, but it plays fantastic. My daughter and I were playing it over the weekend, and she was really getting into it and was able to play. She's 4, and she's able to pick up an Atari joystick and have fun playing this game. It's a testament to what Ed pulled off. And in 4K, fitting 3 giant scrolling levels, I don't know how he does it. He's brilliant.
Well, it's just programming, you know, genius. Like
it is like
a I'm gonna have to, I just bought that book, by the way.
Did you? Oh, that's good. Yeah. And you know what's so funny, it really explains that hardware to you, because a lot of engineers, I'm one of them, love programming for the 2600 because it's the purest of engineering, because it gives you total control of the display, not in a way that's very easy. It's actually like it's like becoming a programming monk. You go and you have to like drop every notion of modern coding and become one with the hardware and learn how to make it do things, because the way it draws things on the screen, you have to time things very precisely, extremely precisely. You're counting cycles, and a cycle, there's only so many cycles as the line of a screen is being drawn. Mm-hmm. And then you have so many cycles between when the beam has to go all the way back to the left side that you can do things. And if you want to put an object on screen, there's only two sprites, they call them, or two player graphics, where you can define anything, and they stretch the length of the screen, but you have to time where the beam is when you want it to turn on and off with whatever data to display anything. And also, if you want it to move that image horizontally, you have to time as the beam's going across the screen to reset it at the right time to put it in the proper position. It's insanity. Nice. It's unbelievable. And people like David Crane, who made Pitfall, mm-hmm. and Ed Freeze, have become these like amazing engineers just because they were able to solve all these problems on an Atari. And so a lot of engineers like to go to it and like after doing all this other stuff and be like, I wanna go to my Zen moment. I want to go to primordial coding. Going to the Atari 2600 is the best way to do that.
Well, you know, talking about obviously older games, but you know, kind of keeping this stuff intact for the future generations. Another great subject that you brought up was classic game collections, and you know that they have been not really showing up lately. Like, you know, sometimes you'll see some stuff on Virtual Console, although that release schedule has been kind of slow. But also we haven't seen any N64 era stuff like PS1 or obviously Sega Saturn's really hard to emulate, but even we had a Dreamcast collection that came out on 360 a couple years ago. And obviously, and I believe you worked on this with Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, and we've talked about that on the show. And that thing for, like, right now you can get that for like $15 and get some of the best games on the Sega Genesis. Oh my God. And
it's an extremely good value. And
there's history like in the disc too. Like there's like content behind every one of the games. Like it is a love letter to those games on the Sega Genesis, and you can get it for PS3 and 360. So you're crazy if you don't already own that.
That's the thing. It's like I've worked on a lot of collections. I worked on that one you were mentioning on PC with Tempest. And
are you serious?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And
I'm sorry, but I pirated that from my school. I apologize, but I copied it disc by disc. Like I put it on five diskettes and copied it over and brought it home. I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
You know what? The games are meant to be played no matter how you have to do it. I used to actually, when I was growing up on the Commodore 64, there weren't many stores that carried Commodore games. And when they did, they carried just like the same ones. There wasn't much variety. But online on bulletin boards, you could download every game from Europe or whatever. But there was this, a brief aside, there's this old woman in the neighborhood that a friend of mine told me about. He's like, dude, you gotta meet Mrs. Cripps. And I'm like, who's Mrs. Cripps? And she's like, she's got everything.
What?
I'm like, what? So I got he told me to bring my box of blank discs, and I arrived at this location he told me to meet him at, and there's all these dirt bikes on the front lawn. And I go into this house, and it smelled like smoke because she was a chain smoker, and she had like dozens of kids all running around. They had floppy drives stacked up, like that. And I came in there, and I met her, and she was like, hey, and everything like that. And she would play this game called Wizard, Ultimate Wizard, all the time. It wasn't the RPG. It was like this Jumpman-style platforming game. She just loved that game. And she just basically enabled all these kids to pirate at her house because her grandson was running a bulletin board that was one of the most elite bulletin boards in the U.S. And so she would get all these games, and then she would just distribute them to all these kids. And these kids were like pushers, right? They would get these games, hop on their dirt bikes, and then go share them with all their friends. It was mind-boggling.
That's
like, to think back on that, it was insane.
That sounds like a drug house for video games.
It was exactly that. I just remember like being equally impressed but also kind of scared of Mrs. Cripps. She was like this older lady. She was like in her 70s and chain smoking and playing games all day.
That's
it was
badass.
Awesome.
That's pretty badass, you know.
So these collections.
Yeah.
I worked on a lot of these. And whenever we propose these collections, because I'm a purist, I want everything from like the sound of the monitor hum to whatever to be represented. And the most disheartening thing usually at the beginning of a lot of these collections is when the client you're working with who's funding the project doesn't want to enough to have the history involved in it. Mm-hmm. And so we would fight tooth and nail, and we'd even try to put it in when we could try to afford it ourselves. So things like the Atari collection, there was this Atari arcade collection. There's videos on there. There's interviews with Nolan Bushnell. And we went so far as to get Jerry Jessup, who now works at Sony, who's an early Atari guy. He has one of the earliest Atari Pongs. We brought it to the place where they put Atari Pong for the first time, and you hear the old story about the coins overflowing and shorting it out.
Yeah.
We went to it was Andy Cap's Tavern in the day, but now it's called Rooster Teeth Feathers. We went there, put the Pong machine in the exact same location in the place where that story happened historically, and got Nolan Bushnell to go there and be interviewed for that disc. It was awesome. But after that collection and seeing the benefit of it, a lot of people just didn't see the value of putting that kind of history in there. And so it's challenging. You'd see some collections we worked on where there wasn't much history, but you can rest assured, we fought tooth and nail to try to get in there. In the case of the Sega collection, they were awesome. They went just hit the archives and interviewed everybody they could in Japan and threw in whatever they could afford to put in there. And they were the kind of partner you want to do that with. Same with Capcom. Capcom, we did the Capcom collections. And those were really well received, and we put the same kind of effort into those as well.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny that you bring these up just because recently we had the, I think they called it the Neo Geo X, and this was a really big build up for this. Like, people thought, oh my god, it looks just like an AES. It's going to have all these great games. Plus, you're going to be able to get these game packs. And then they got to people's doors, and the emulation was terrible. The sound was gross. And it completely, like, it just shows, like, if the budget is not put into it and the quality is not there, people will be able to tell the difference. They don't want just, you know, you to throw, you know, a bunch of ROMs in a terrible emulator and burn it to a disc and send it to people. They want to actually have that same experience they had growing up. So do you think that that is something that we'll see, is maybe more like PlayStation 1 collections, or are those like too big to put on a disc or something?
It's hard to say. Like, we can emulate them now, like take an ISO image from a disc and emulate it and do that sort of thing. But a lot of the problems I see right now are with the preservation of a lot of these digital games, because once they're pulled from a digital network, where are they? And a lot of people, like, and I don't blame them, will delete these games to make room for more games. And then someday you might be like, oh, I'm going to go play that game again. And you realize it's off the network. It might not be on Steam anymore. It might not be on Xbox Live. Where are those games? And the answer is pretty frightening. When you find out about a lot of these delisted games, and you, in our case, like professionally, I tried to go out there and see, like, is there any chance we can put these games on disc or preserve them somehow? They don't even know where they are. They don't, like, if Microsoft didn't keep a copy, they don't have one, and the game is virtually lost.
Well, it's like, what comes to mind is the on 360, when Midway got bought or got broken up, like, I bought Smash TV, like, when I got my Xbox 360, because there wasn't a ton at launch to play, and Smash TV is one of the greatest games of all time. And then a couple years ago, you can download it if you bought it, but if you didn't buy it, you can't get it. And now that Xbox Live is going to be going in 5 years, then we probably will never be able to download it ever again.
That's the scary stuff. And like those games, I was involved in those as well, those early ones. Give a lot of credit here, because like the guy who masterminded all this emulation for the most part and kind of set the trajectory even before MAME and all that was this guy, Jeff Vavasor, who now has his own company called Code Mystics. He's amazing. He's the first guy who kind of sat down and said, we need to emulate these classic games and try to emulate them perfectly for preservation as well as entertainment. And he was like, he walked the line great. And he's still doing that today. He did the Infocom collection for iPhone and all stuff. And likewise, there's other guy, Dan Filner, who is like this unknown, like behind the curtain guy, who's brought the Capcom collection and the Sega collections and stuff like that to market as well. I've worked with all these guys. We work on these collections together, and these guys knew that, especially when we've been porting some of these games, that as we work with some of these clients, we would ask for the actual source code to things and whatnot, and we would find out from them that it didn't exist. In some cases, we're working with Capcom on something, and it was a pretty big franchise game for them. They thought they had the source code, and then they realized they had written over the backup tapes with a backup of a newer game they were working on because they didn't feel like going out and buying new backup tapes.
How does that happen?
I don't know. And it's like, it's horrifying to hear that stuff. And so they end up relying on hoping and the hope that some of the people who used to work at the company or whatever may have taken home a backup or something, or, you know, done so, sort of thing. So we've actually saved games by contacting people on the team who then go through their garage or whatever and find an old hard drive or an old tape, and we're able to like save those games. But more often than not, you hear the other side of it, which is like, we don't even know where it is anymore. So when these networks go down, that's the biggest fear I have, is like, where are they going to go? And I think going back to the old Mrs. Cripps at her house, chain smoking and giving copies away, I think our best bet is going to be the pirates that are out there right now, BitTorrenting all those XBLA games and PSN games. Because as the actual publisher who no longer owns any of the source code or can't find it or whatever is out there, there's these weird collections that people and things that people are distributing online of hacked versions of those games that still run, and there's ways to run those games. So as shameful as it is, I think there's going to be a time where we're like, that's the only recourse is to go after or find those games online, and hopefully people have backed them up properly.
Well, I mean, what are you going to do from here on out when we're not, I mean, you're not burning stuff to PCBs anymore. You don't have a cart, you know, even with those, there's going to be like a shelf life. But with all this digital stuff, like you said, that's part of the reason why I don't buy a ton of games digitally, and except pretty much only on the Vita. But everything else, I like to have some sense of security that if I wanted to hold on to this for 20 years, I could, you know, put it into something and then play it.
Yeah, that's there's no good answer to that. And, you know, as OSs are now being updated constantly and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. a game that may have been discontinued, it still sits on your system, three updates later might not run, and they're not keeping that game up. And then there's no way you're going to be able to play that game, even sometimes 5 years after you had it.
Has there been any kind of, you know, like group effort or anything like that, or even thoughts about putting together some kind of organization to just say, hey, this is going to be the video game, you know, preservation society where we are going to make sure we have one copy. It is like the, you know, like that, it's the library on Doctor Who where they had a copy of every single book of all time. Like, is that like, we need that to happen, right?
Well, there's that online site, the big website. I can't believe I can barely remember anything on this. There's that big website, the archive, the Internet Archive, with ROMs from old systems of old computers and that sort of thing. And they've put Java emulation of a lot of those systems up there, so mm-hmm. you can actually play those games. But you're not going to be able to do that with Xbox 360 for a long time or some of these other systems. And I'm worried about the time between now and when that's possible, where all that stuff's going to go. There's been a few groups who've attempted to come up with methods and procedures to help preserve these games, and they've approached publishers. But a lot of publishers aren't taking it seriously because it's time and money to invest in taking that archive, giving it to somebody to curate, and find a way to keep it live the whole time. Because the people who have to curate it have to have development hardware. The development hardware has to be able to be flashed to whatever spec it was to make that game run and all this sort of stuff. It's very complicated. And so it's because it's so difficult, it's nobody's willing to really invest the time to do it. So a lot of the efforts that are out there are really coming down to just guerrilla efforts, and there's not many of them. There, Frank Cifaldi and I went out to the Library of Congress a couple years ago, and they're very anxious to preserve video games over there. They've been doing it for a little while, and they're wanting to learn how to do that with modern games and that sort of thing. And they're just not quite equipped yet. I mean, they will do anything. Like, the Library of Congress wants to preserve video games as important relics, and they just don't have the support. They don't have publisher support. They don't have people going in there and giving them what they need to do it. Yeah. They'll buy the hardware. They'll do whatever, but it's just they're trying really hard to get answers for that, and it's just a hard problem to solve.
Like you said, even to get a hold of some of this stuff, it's so expensive for some of these games. The prices are just kind of going through the roof on the resale market. So I hope something comes through. I know I saw a video of it was Chris Kohler on Wired. Was that where he was, that huge library of games and stuff like that he was going through? I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I think he was actually at the Strong Museum of Play, brilliant place. Those guys are awesome, and they do incredible work towards preserving games and also make sure games are playable. Part of the preservation is that they are actively able to be played, because that's just what they're for. And Strong is really probably one of the better – probably one of the furthest along organizations to solving that problem. And they're also the most open to working with other organizations to solve it. So that's where Chris was. He found some great stuff. And Strong's been doing incredible things with preserving or acquiring collections and that sort of thing to help preserve these games.
Very cool. Let's take one more quick break. Then we're going to get some questions from the listeners out there, the forums and the Twitters and all that stuff. So stick around. We'll be right back.
All right.
All right, well, the listeners out there were fantastic. They submitted a bunch of questions. And one of the things that I forgot to mention right off the top of the show that you are well known for, you got like a ton of pieces in the news, but you actually hacked Donkey Kong so your daughter could play as Pauline, correct?
That's correct. It was something that I didn't think anything twice about. And then in a matter of days, suddenly realized it was this thing that everybody was so interested in. I remember doing it. It was my daughter. She came to me and she said that, we'd been playing a lot of Mario games. She really likes Donkey Kong particularly. And I introduced her to Super Mario Brothers 2, which brought Princess Peach I've got her official name in there, Princess Toadstool, added that character. So she liked to play as that character. So when we went back to Donkey Kong, she was actually really kind of upset that she couldn't play as Pauline or the Princess Toadstool. Mm-hmm. And so, I kind of explained it to her, and then kind of forgot about it for a little bit. But then later that night, I was thinking, like, oh, geez, I've hacked so many games in my whole life. Like, if she wants to do that, I can do that. So the next day, I was just talking to one of the engineers in the office, and he kind of explained how the NES architecture worked for me in a quick brief. And that next night, I just went to work on replacing all the sprites. And it was kind of challenging because Pauline is taller than Mario. So I had to figure out how to make her look the same, but at half the size, and then how to swap out the palettes and all stuff. So I worked all night. And as I was doing it, I was posting to my Facebook page. And a lot of my friends, one of them, Adam Boyes, who's now a VP over at Sony, you've probably seen him on TV, but he's like, do you mind if I post this to Reddit? And I'm just like, yeah, whatever, go ahead. And then the Saturday, that was the next day, and I had this charity event to go to for my son's school. And on the way there, my wife's like, don't look at your phone. Don't, you do this all the time, whatever. I'm like, okay, fine. So we're at this thing, and the phone just kept buzzing and buzzing and buzzing and buzzing. And finally, I'm just like, you know what? This could be an emergency from the babysitter or something. So I stepped out, and I had all these text messages and all these missed calls. And everybody's like, your story's blowing up on the internet and all stuff. And I'm just thinking, like, what story? I thought maybe I said something horrible in another interview or something, but I had no idea. And then finally, like, somebody was pointing to the Reddit page, and it had reached, I think, number 2 at this time on the front page of Reddit. And I'm just like, oh my God, like, this thing's what this is insane. And then after that, it was just like 3 weeks of bizarre interview requests for television shows and all stuff. And at the end of the day, it's just a hack like any other hack. But I think the it was at the right time because Anita Sarkeesian had just done this women tropes in video games, like the damsel in distress sort mm-hmm. of thing. I had not known anything about that. And people kept mentioning that. And so it introduced me to her videos. And then it kind of all became clear. It's like, this is an issue. I'm usually heads down working on games and doing stuff that I don't even really pay attention to the issues in the game industry. I just kind of like, I got to make this game. I got to get this out. So that really opened my eyes, and I could see why people were very excited about it. So it was really fun. And people ask me all the time, are you going to work on any more, that sort of thing? Like, that was so in the moment. It feels almost weird if I were to do more, as if like trying to capitalize on it. But if my daughter wants me to hack something, or my son wants me to hack something, of course I'm going to do that. But so far, like, I remember like the week after that Donkey Kong thing exploded, people wanted to talk to my daughter. And so I did this video. They wanted to see a video. And I'm like, hey, Ellis, what's your favorite video game? And she's like, looks and thinks for a second, she's like, Dig Dug. So it was already over for her. Nice. She's like, I'm past Donkey Kong.
Perfect. No, yeah, the music of Dig Dug is something that is magical. People should all experience it. If you have not played Dig Dug, find a way to play it. You can play it on almost everything these days.
I always wanted to get that little soundtrack and put it into a little chip, and like every step you take with your tennis shoes activate it.
Like the LA lights. Like the LA exactly. lights when I was growing up, like the shoes that would light up every time you take a step.
That's exactly what I'm referencing. Because like if you could just do that with that music, so you just go walking and there's that Dig Dug music, you stop just like in the game.
Okay, the who stops. Do you need to talk to, and then who's setting up the Kickstarter page? Because I need some size 12s.
This is our next project.
I'm serious about that. You set up a Kickstarter, anything under $1,000, I will get some Dig Dug shoes with optional gun or whatever pump to blow up enemies. So the first question that we have, and I will apologize if I pronounce names incorrectly. I've been doing this stuff for 7 years, but sometimes I almost always mispronounce names. Chris Siegel wanted to know, following that, Mike, do you have any plans to do any other games for your daughter? I guess you kind of answered that.
Sort of. And, you know, the plan I do have is I've actually been involving my kids a lot more in game development. And we had them, it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, my wife had to go do something. So I took them up to the office and we just sat in the office over a weekend. And I just gave them a bunch of paper and they spent the whole day designing games and they wanted to like make them and this is what their levels would look like. And they just like kind of took their favorite things that they liked on iPad games and whatever. So my next real project outside of the hacking stuff is really, I kind of want to take all their ideas and start working on some games with them and see where that goes. But that's probably what's next. And right now I've got a stack of paper with some of the most bizarre ideas, most of them including like or involving butts and other things. But if I sort through enough of it, I think I can do something that's not Booger Man and get it out there with those guys.
Yeah, maybe like a WarioWare collection of just all these little games. That'd be cool.
It would be fun.
At Chair Home on Twitter, with such a massive collection, are there things that you have had to turn down, sell, or donate just for space considerations, or do you also have off-site storage?
I don't have off-site storage, but I've slowed down quite a bit because there are so many people like Chris Kohler and Frank Cifaldi and Steve Lin out there and a bunch of others who I've met in my journeys. Now I feel like I'm only going to particularly grab things that are more meaningful to me, like old Atari stuff or Super Nintendo stuff and everything like that. But I know of other homes that this stuff can go to if there's no museum available to take it. So I generally now when things come through, I'm like, okay, I know what museum this is for. And if there's no museum for it, I know which person could probably have it. And if there's no person could probably have it, I keep it. But the one thing I try to prevent, and like most people like me, never, ever should it like – go somewhere where it's going to be thrown out or destroyed or lost. Mm-hmm. So, but I have slowed down quite a bit. I can't fit in. It's like Tetris. At one point I had to move out half of the room because there was some water issues with the house, and just half the room filled up probably three times the physical size of what it was before it moved, which is it defies physics. So if I were to ever move this around or try to fit anything else, I don't know how I'm going to do it.
Wow. And that reminded me that it is great. I was watching a lot of the live stream yesterday, but we're recording this out of order. But Outer Lands did hit their goal, so we should be seeing some more of your stuff, hopefully on Outer Lands in the future. So congratulations to those guys. I cannot wait.
They are awesome
videos. Oh my God.
It's going to be so good. The stuff that like I know that I can't share right now that they're doing is awesome. You're going to love it.
Fantastic. It's just such a – man, time's going to fly. I'm sure it will. So we got a question from @data64prime. Any tips on cleaning up old carts to get them back to 100%?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's the right thing to do or not, but I've always used like isopropyl, if I'm saying it right, 99% rubbing alcohol because it dries so fast with a Q-tip. That usually works. And then that doesn't work. Like the last resort is like a pencil eraser or a red rubber eraser. Mm-hmm. But before you do that, there's also electric contact spray you can buy from any electronic store if you get on Amazon that's made specifically for electrical contacts. That stuff works amazing. It'll get the most grime out of any situation without damaging the circuit boards or anything.
No way. I've not heard of this.
You know, it's relatively new for me. It was probably like a few years ago. Somebody just brought it by and I'm like, check this out. And it was amazing. And so I recommend that. That seems to work the best. But rubbing alcohol is usually in the house and you don't have to order anything for that. But that will solve most of your problems, the electrical spray.
They sell it on Amazon and it's super cheap too.
Who knew?
Well, it's funny. There's this great website called the Nintendo Repair Shop. And they sell these kits that, you know, come with the special bit to open up your games and this crazy white mixture that seems to get everything and you'll always get those contacts clean and then some alcohol. But if I can get this stuff and it's only $5 for a huge can of it, I'm going to get all over that.
It works great. I clean a lot of old games with that stuff.
Yeah, not to keep bringing it up, but those MVS carts, those boards.
Oh yeah,
are
they
huge.
Need it. They need the cleaning.
Yeah, there's nothing grosser than like a arcade machine that hasn't been cleaned in 20 years, and just imagine like that's why like the corrosion on those like four slot boards is just it just blows me away.
We have like 20 or 30 games here in the office, arcade machines, and one of them was having all these problems. And so we finally opened it up. It's a game called Off the Wall, and it kind of opens from the front. We looked at the board, and it was just like, it probably has not been opened for 30 years, and it looks like things have lived in there, and the contacts were just black. And so as soon as we cleaned it, the game looked like it was brand new. It's amazing how much that affects the video signal and everything.
Yeah, people put these things in barns, like rats and bees and birds will end up living in them, and then they still somehow
safe in there.
Yeah, oh, totally. It's nice and warm and cozy. The plywood is just perfect. So next question from at Sean697. This is a great question too. My Saturn Model 1 died, and I want to replace it with a Japanese model. What version would you recommend?
Oh, let's see. Like, let me get my Saturn logic in here. I knew there was the original Saturns had the round buttons, right? Those, I forgot which version those were. I would recommend finding that original version, even the Japanese version that had those. Mm-hmm. They're just built better. Usually those first run, I could have this all, like, I'm going to speak as if I'm an expert here, but maybe I'm lying or wrong about something. But what I recall is those first run Saturns, just like the Dreamcast, were pretty well built. They're kind of like built to show off that this thing could last forever. But then when things got cheaper, or they had to be cheaper to make more margins on the things, they generally will cheapen up the board and put less things in there, things that are more prone to breaking. More often than not, those first run systems are the better ones. And if I recall correctly, Saturn in particular is like that. So if you can get the first run Saturn Japanese model or the first run US Saturn model, that's probably the better one to have.
Yeah, it's on my list of things to pick up because I've never owned a Sega Saturn. And it is just kind of an interesting console in terms of the capabilities, but it does have some great 2D fighters on there. So I got my eyes on one of those white Sega Saturns. They just look so great.
Yep. They're great. I like the system. I was a PlayStation guy at the time, but then going back and having a Saturn and playing Panzer Dragoon and all those games, it's really nice.
Well, that's like another game that they completely lost the source code for, right?
Yep.
At least I remember hearing that on some podcasts. We got a question from Rob Hall from the very cool Boston Retro Gamers like sub thing of Facebook, who found me through the internet, which is great to meet these guys, some local retro gamers. He wanted to know, what was your involvement with the development of Super Street Fighter HD Remix? Is it stressful to work with such an established franchise? And that is a franchise that is also so beloved.
That's a really good question. So first, the easy part, like I was the studio head for Backbone Entertainment, and I was the guy who inked the deal with Capcom to do that, as well as kind of oversee the production on that game, plus Puzzle Fighter HD Remix, 1942 Joint Strike, and I think it was Wolf of the Battlefield Commando 3. Mm-hmm. We did a 4-game deal with Capcom. That's where I met some of my best friends in that process over there at Capcom during that. And it was really challenging. First and foremost, we had to develop a game that would work well online with single frame and subframe synchronization, which is there's a technology out there called GGPO that's really popular. We had done our own version of the same theory of that. And at one point, we were going to use GGPO, but we were so far along in what we had developed. But that was probably one of the most challenging aspects of the game, was making sure that people can competitively play Street Fighter online with spectators without feeling like the game was lagging or having any issues. That took a long time. Bigger than that was when you take a game that had a certain kind of look, and this is before Street Fighter 4, and there's a whole story about Street Fighter 4, I'll say for another time, which is very long, that I was involved in. But before Street Fighter 4 came out, it was hard to visualize what these characters looked like in high definition, because you could take something like Robotron, and what does the robot look like when you make him in HD and close up? Nobody knows. Everybody has a different version of it. Same with Street Fighter. It was amazing because if you look at the characters and how they were drawn in the classic game, the Super Street Fighter for the arcades, it's very low resolution, and the muscles are not in actual places where they're supposed to be, and proportions are all really wrong. And when you have to redraw that and try to interpret those things, even when you're working closely with the original artists, it doesn't match what a lot of the players thought it was supposed to look like. For instance, some of the earliest artwork that we're working on, in close basically in concert with the original artists for Street Fighter, had leaked online, and it was like this amazing like outcry from the fans who were like, these look horrible, these things look terrible, I hope the game doesn't look like this when it ships. And what ended up being like this horrible leak that like Capcom, it didn't come from our company, thankfully, but somewhere Capcom had leaked out. They were just trying to figure out who leaked and how horrible this was, and they didn't know if they were going to fire the guy for doing it or whatever. It turned out that that was the best thing that could happen because we got immediate feedback from the fans. And from that point forward, we had all learned together, Capcom and ourselves, that we should share as much as we can about this game as we develop it, because rather than go all this way and spend all this money and come out with something that nobody wants, we need to be like vetting this against the core user base. And this is at a time when Capcom was really building up Capcom Unity, their community website and stuff. So it was like, it was a perfect storm of like, let's start involving everybody. Let's start showing more of the game as we develop it and that sort of thing. But the artwork was top down, hands down, the hardest aspect of building that game because it was so subjective and so challenging to get the fans on board for it. And when we finally did it, it was kind of a relief. And the game did great. It sold really well. People were really happy with it. That we had to do some updates and these sorts of things, but ultimately everything we set out to do worked.
Fun fact, the very first game I ever did, I interned at Game Trailers after college, and I convinced my boss at the time to allow me to do some stuff with the editorial side, and that was the very first game I ever did game capture footage for.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was when the demo came out, because the demo came out a couple weeks before the game kind of came out, and we like that's all we were playing in the office. We're supposed to capture like I think 30 minutes or something like that, so it could be chopped up into like some highlight reel. And I think we ended up playing for like 3 or 4 hours straight, just like constantly going back and forth. And it was again what we talked about earlier in the podcast about that awesome, like just buddies on the couch, like handing, like just shuffling the controller from person to person to person. Just that day, I got to really like meet the staff. Like that was my way to like not be an intern, but just be like another guy playing video games with a bunch of other people.
That's one of those games too that was a really brutal production for us. Like it was challenging. People were living in the office, but at any moment, everybody wanted to keep playing the game. There was not a moment where we were fed up with it. There's some guys who probably say they were, but they were still up late playing the game for the fun of it, even though they're complaining the whole time. So it was pretty fun.
It's a beautiful game. It's a game that I still to this day have on the hard drive of my PlayStation 3.
It has awesome.
Traveled from 4 PlayStation 3s and is still on there. And for people that want to see some more on that game and the development, I know there was a section in, speaking of Area 5, they did a Street Fighter documentary that is for up for free on YouTube. You can just watch. And I know there was a piece in that talking at least about the art in the game, so you can see some of the cool things that you know you guys had to go through in terms of like hit detection and things like that.
Oh, it was crazy. Yeah, hit detection was a big challenge because things were so nebulous on the old game. And there was actually some errors in the old game that a lot of the pros know about that like we'd have big debates with Capcom and even some of the people in the community on should we fix this or not. And we would always opt for not. But in some cases, when we did the remix mode, we had to fix some things.
Very cool. Okay, let's see. Thing I don't want to wrap up on this, but I think this is going to be the last thing that we have time to talk about. You have for people that aren't already, make sure that you're following Mike on Twitter, because he's got some awesome pictures of the stuff that he's working on. It's at Mike J. Micah. And you've been working on this game and posting like Vine videos, and I'm still trying to like wrap my head around this, because I've been like clicking on these videos and I'm like, all right, this seems to have like the vibe of a game that A, I need immediately, and B, I need to have like 4 or 5 people over to start playing. And I don't know how to pronounce it. Is it IDARB?
Yeah, that's the acronym. It's a horrible name. Like right now, there's just not been any effort in the name, but it just sticks. And this goes back to I actually wanted to do something I used to do when I was a kid, and we talked about it earlier. I wanted to start making something that I could share with my friends and have them give me feedback, and we'd have that like kind of feedback loop. But the problem is a lot of my friends are no longer living near me or whatever, and there's a lot of people I know that I would want to involve, but like I can't just get a hold of them. So I decided that one day I'm just going to start a clean slate of code, and I'm going to draw something on the screen, and I'm going to post it, and I'm going to invite everybody who's following me on Twitter to throw ideas at me, and I'm going to try to implement as many of them as I can. And so the first post I posted, I think, it was simply, it draws a red box. And that's where iDARP comes from. It draws a red box. And I posted that up and I invited everybody, give me some ideas. And it's just became an avalanche. It was, and it's still going. Like, I get emails, I get direct messages, I get tweet replies, I get all stuff. And I build this giant list and I try to tackle all of it. And what started as just a red box on screen has now turned into an two to eight player battle arena game that is captured pretty much my generation's, your generation, and stuff we were talking about earlier. It's the couch play game that has, it feels like Bomberman meets NHL 94 meets Towerfall. Yeah. And it's like this bizarre mix of things, and we can't stop playing it in the office. And we've had people over. We just had somebody from another company over yesterday, and he wanted to see it, so we put it on. And he's like, I want to keep playing this. He's like, can I come back tomorrow? And so we're like, yes, this is exactly what we want. It's just completely homegrown, organic, and I continue to get feedback. I put it all in, and people have been drawing characters for it, and it's just insane. I will hook you up with a copy soon so you can try it out for yourself.
Yeah, and not to jump too far ahead, but do you have an idea of, you know, a release window or platforms for this?
It's probably sooner rather than later. I'm probably going to be showing it at a little bit at GDC, and I'm probably showing it in a bigger way at E3. To be perfectly honest, I actually got contacted not too long ago from a major publisher who's like, we want to be part of this. And awesome. If we can sign this agreement, we want to do all these great things with it. And I haven't signed it yet because I still want to keep that kind of purity of what it is right now. But the interest has been incredible. Like, just a few days ago, I got another opportunity from it's just an incredible you can imagine, like, the place you want to be are places like Steam and all stuff. It's one of those caliber places. It was like, we want to support this game, what do we have to do, here's what we offer and all stuff. So to me, it's like one of these things where people are just seeing little glimpses of this thing, but if for those who are paying attention, you'll pick up that this is a couch battle game of old school nature with incredibly fun multiplayer, and people who play it just can't stop laughing or yelling at each other. It's got that weird kind of perfect storm vibe to it that you just can't plan for. It just happened. And it happened because I just opened up a window and started to code something and asked everybody around the world, tell me what you want. And now it's kind of coalesced into this thing. So it's very exciting.
That's great. I mean, these are the games that I seem to get more excited about these days. I've made almost a pact with myself that I'm pretty much done going to next-gen hardware immediately. I bought a PS4, but I kind of ran out of steam with that. But these are the games that I just love seeing, like, you know, on the Vita. Vita has tons of them. Like, that's probably why the Vita has been my favorite platform this generation, because there are so many games like this on PSN, and same thing with, like, just PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 3. Like, it seems like, you know, Sony's been doing such a great job getting that stuff out there, and now Xbox is right behind them now too. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I, before this all started happening, I was really getting into that Nidhogg game, the sword fighting, you know, which I think is brilliant. And we were playing that in the office, and I knew we were onto something when that suddenly went to the wayside. Everybody just wants to play this one now in the office, which is phenomenal. So I will get you a copy of it so you can – I want your input, and I'm going to include everything I can from you.
Perfect. Well, I think that is – we're coming up on an hour and a half, so we should probably wrap up there. But this is me publicly saying right now that we got to have you on again, because I think we're just, like, scratching the surface of things to talk about. And, you know, I'd love to pick your brain on some more things down the road.
I would love to. This is so fun to do.
So for people out there, the best place to kind of, like, follow you and just obviously to check your stuff out, is that just on Twitter, is the, you know, the way people can see what you're
doing? Follow me on Twitter, and that's the best way to see the latest. I'm trying to be more and more disciplined on putting more updates up there, so in the next few weeks it'll be a much better place to come see the latest in Mike Mica news.
Perfect. All right. Well, everyone out there, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please, if you do like the show, jump on iTunes, subscribe on there. That's the best way to support us and keep us going. And also go to youtube.com/backinmyplay. I have constantly putting up weekend rental videos on there, just playing some bunch of Neo Geo stuff right now, but I'm going to be recording some, this will be in the past right now, but some Neo Geo Pocket Color stuff, because why not? That's what kind of I'm pumped about right now. So Mike, thank you so much for taking the time. This is what it's all about. This is so much fun, and I hope the audience out there is enjoying it too. This is the audience that is perfect for this discussion. So I can't wait to hear the feedback from it.
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin. And thanks to everybody who sent in the questions. That was great.
All right, guys. Thanks as always. We'll see you next time on Back in My Plan.